Good evening, everybody. This is Jim Brilling. Welcome to our Sunday evening call-in of the NEA BPD. Tonight we have a Connecting the Dots session. It's kind of a listen-in on a clinician seminar, if you will. And before I get to that, I want to mention from some feedback is that introduce myself. For the last 12 years, I was the key person or the lead person at the National Institute of Mental Health for borderline personality disorder research and related activities. And I retired earlier this year at 73 years of age for other things. But I wanted to keep a connection with the exciting momentum and developments in BPD. And I'm doing that primarily through the NEA BPD and particularly through this call session right now. So that's kind of me. And one of the reasons I'm so interested to stay in is the literally transformation in the field from 10 years ago, beginning where we almost had, it was just pretty despondent of hopelessness and difficulty and discouragement. And the longitudinal studies of Mary Zanarini and John Gunderson and the other people in the collaborative longitudinal studies of personality disorders have shown a encouraging progression to remission and improvement. And Mary Zanarini next Sunday will be giving us an update on that with the encouragement and some challenges that still remain, not unsurprisingly. But one of our listeners last week on the very exciting general psychiatric management approach for borderline commented just exactly on this transformation that 10 years ago there was essentially nothing. Glimmers in the weeds, if you will, in the yards, but nothing substantial. And here was we have multiple treatment models now with a reasonable to very strong evidence base of encouragement. So I think we're going to see dramatic changes and improvements in treatment, and, of course, those won't be the last word. The other thing I wanted to mention is I think a number of the listeners for the first several sessions have been very generous and good in making donations to support these activities. I'm volunteering. Harry Hoffman is volunteering her time as both president of the NEA BPD, which doesn't have a lot of glory but a lot of work. Other people are volunteering to make these things happening, including all our speakers, including our speakers tonight. But there are expenses for the webpage, for making the recordings of these sessions, audio recordings, so that they can be available 24/7. If you miss something, you can come back and get it later and listen in. And we've had a very nice response that rivals that of public radio. But if you find these call-in sessions helpful and interesting, remember if you went to a meeting or you bought a book, what it would cost you to do that, and your donation would be very, very helpful. And you can do that donation on the NEA BBT webpage on the right-hand side in the column. If you click on Donate, it takes you to a page where you can either use PayPal or a credit card. And thanks to those who have contributed, and I invite you, if you can, to join the ranks of those wonderful supporters. Turning to tonight's session, as I say, these are we have a psychiatrist, and we have a psychologist of some experience in the field and also some knowledge of the research literature. And they confer before a session for a topic and a focus and then kind of go at it in exchange between themselves. Both all the way, by the way, have training in DBT, not only training, but have mastered it so that both have been trainers and in one case have run the DBT operation for Marsha Linehan. So we have some real expertise in the treatment model, but also awareness of developments in the field and other approaches. So it's kind of a unique opportunity, not just to chat with another clinician, but to hear people with such lengths of experience and perspective on the field and wisdom, I would say, kind of talking about the different aspects of the clinical work. And if you have comments or reactions, please email them in so we can pass them on. And they can take this into account in their future sessions. So, oh my God, I have gone longer than I had intended. Let me just put the notes aside here and get out of the way so we can have our Connecting the Dots clinical seminar session.
All right. Thank you, Jim. This is Charlie Swenson.
And, hey, it's Kelly Kerner here.
That's Kelly Kerner. I'm in our very first one of these, we determined that I'm the Lone Ranger and Kelly is Tonto. So we can you can go by that, too. God, Kelly, we should come back and play some more of that theme music. I didn't get it ready for tonight. Look, Jim said we're going to be going at it, so that made me think about the debates that are going on, and we should probably establish some rules here, Kelly. I mean, I think we should name a topic, and then I'll speak for 2 minutes, and then you can speak for 2 minutes, and then we can punch each other. As a way to find the synthesis. That seems to be the way it's going in the other debates.
No kidding.
Okay. Well, let me, you know, you and I have touched base a little bit before this, but when we were brainstorming for ideas for topics and we went back and forth, it was actually your thought of this topic and to call it something like, what in the hell is Wise Mind anyway? And I loved the title, and I actually wanted to start just to ask you, since I never did ask you, what did you mean? Why did you put it that way?
I think the concept itself, if you take it just as maybe where its roots came from, which were from Zen Buddhism, you know, it has a lot of connotations from that, and yet brought into a treatment model, in this case DBT, it has a much more specific meaning. It's often taught in a certain way, and I think you might, you know, say something about that. But the essence of it is you can talk at a conceptual level, but there's the experiential level of operating from wise mind or going to wise mind or speaking mm-hmm. or acting from wise mind that's very hard to put into words. And so, you know, my own experience, both as myself but also trying to teach others, like, how do you access that? How do you act with wisdom in your life? Mm-hmm. How do you discern, you know, what is actually truly wise? I think it's pretty complicated. So mm-hmm. I got very excited, actually. I did a fair amount of background reading and prep just on kind of more of the conceptual part of wise mind. Mm-hmm. So I'm really curious where the conversation will take us tonight. How about you? When you think of wise mind, did you have some preliminary definitions you wanted to start with?
Well, yeah. I mean, the history of the term wise mind for me, I think, came in at the beginning of learning DBT and teaching it, and it being the famous first handout of the first class, basically, of emotion mind and rational mind, Venn diagram with wise mind in the middle, and then having explained it for, you know, about 23 years since then, to myself, to my team members, to my, patients, to groups, to audiences, it just, you know, that's what I love. You would think that after 23 years of going over this concept and then reading things about it, that you wouldn't start by saying, what the hell is wise mind anyway? but that's still, it's still a good way to put it. I mean, because I did try to think of definitions of what is it and what isn't it. And then ultimately, how do I think of it? Since I do refer to it in my own mind many, many times when I'm, mm-hmm. dealing with situations. I mean, I've been on a recently, for instance, just anecdotally, and then I want to mention some definitions, but I got back just today from, you know, trip number two of looking at colleges with my high school senior son. And I've never been through this process, actually, even for myself. You know, when I went to college, I didn't go through this whole process the way he is. And, you know, it really is, you aren't there yet, but you will be. And it really engages your rational mind. It engages your emotional mind. It engages your judgments. It engages your fears and worries. It engages kind of getting to know your kid. And at first, I was a little worried that I was going to have trouble finding just a balance and just being there and being helpful to him. Because he's not so sure what he's been wanting, and he's not so totally confident about all these things. And so I found that ultimately, long story short, about where I come down with these things is that I needed to get myself into wise mind, or operate, as you'll hear. I don't quite think of it as getting into wise mind as much as operating wise-mindedly. In order for him to be able to also operate in a wise-minded way himself, and both of us really are coming down a lot to something I wasn't thinking about at the beginning of prepping for this a few days ago, which was core values. And I'll get back to where I see that as fitting in, but I just felt like the core value of what's the most important thing here? You know, if you add them all up, well, the most important thing for me was my relationship with my son. And beyond that, and that, you know, in other words, if anything threatened that, forget it, you know, or, you know, back off from it, because that's the core there. But then there's, you know, next things and next things. And I couldn't really be in wise mind without repeatedly moving to the kind of deep values. Let me get back to it. Let me move back your question about defining it. I realize that when I've taught, and you've probably done the same, and we've probably sometimes done it together, you know, I think the language that we all use in DBT, like getting to wise mind, is something people say a lot, just, you know, colloquially. You know, I wonder, how do you get to wise mind? Which suggests, if you really think of that, that wise mind is a place and is a noun.
Or a state. Yeah, or a state, maybe.
Yeah, well, then I was going to say that, too. And some people say locating wise mind. Some people say accessing. I want to access wise mind, which suggests more that it's a state. Like it's not a place, but it's a state to access, sort of like download the state of being in wise mind. A state that's there, that suggests, but it's just out of reach, and you need to access it somehow. And then in DBT, we teach using six core mindfulness skills as various ways to access wise mind. But that still is a way of thinking of it as a noun. It's a state that exists, but a potential state that can be brought into action. Then, you know, I think one of the ways Marcia has taught wise mind that's been incredibly helpful and helpful to me and a lot of people is the way of thinking of it that you ask wise mind a question as a clinical technique or as a personal technique. Like it'd be like when I was with my son during the weekend and we're driving around to upstate New York into the Adirondack Mountains where it was so beautiful. It's easier to get to wise mind there, I'll tell you, but that would mean asking myself, you know, so wise mind, how should I behave? How should I go about this? You know, what would be a wise-minded way? And you kind of, I think that Marcia's way of asking that is to ask wise mind and don't rush the answer. Wait for the answer. There's not a rote answer. It'll come when it'll come. Reminded me, actually, as a growing up Christian and having attended church and Sunday school a lot, you know, we almost would have talked about Jesus that way. That really it's sort of like, you know, what would Jesus say? What would Jesus have done? I think different religions have different approaches to this, and it's almost like wise mind is mysterious enough to have a little bit of that kind of quality, that there's something really important there to call out and ask about. And wisdom, I think, is another one. And finally, I'll just say the integration of rational mind and emotion mind. But actually that always leaves most people a little short when they're teaching it. Like, well, wait a minute, that sounds a little rational. And in fact, I think that wise mind, for me, is more of a process and more of a quality. And I'll read a couple definitions, then I want to hand off to you and hear what you think of these things and then continue. But for instance, let me just see if I wrote these down when I was reading various things. So here was one definition. But, you know, this is where actually it's hard to find definitions of wise mind. It's easier to find definitions of what it is to be mindful.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm interested in how you relate these two, but I'll just start there because it sounds pretty close to what I think of as getting to wise mind. So here's one. Mindfulness is a quality. It's a quality of human consciousness that's characterized by an accepting awareness and enhanced attention to the constant stream of lived experience. Now, one thing I love in that definition is this constant stream of lived experience, this idea that there is a constant stream of lived experience and one can bring mindfulness to that or not, or more or less. I do think of it that way. And it also has, as every definition I found, the word awareness and attention. That awareness and attention, though I'm not sure that totally gets it for me. It's a big part of it. John Kabat-Zinn, has a lot of, he writes books on mindfulness, but one common definition of his is it's paying attention in a particular way, on purpose, in the present moment, and non-judgmentally. I like about that now the inclusion of the present moment, because to be thinking about the past kind of curtails or can curtail awareness of the living, this stream of life that's happening at this exact moment. And thinking about the future can curtail that also. Although, in response to a question at a retreat with Thich Nhat Hanh once, somebody asked him, you know, how can I think about the future and stay mindful? And he said, you bring the future into the present. Basically, gave a longer answer than that and more elegant than mine. But it was really saying, you know, if your family is planning a vacation and you really want a good vacation, you want to think about the future while grounded completely in the present moment. Mm-hmm. And you're more likely to think of a vacation that might work, you know, that sort of thing. So there's other definitions, and they all come down to a bunch of common ingredients, some of which are very useful to me, and I can get back to them, but I want to hand off to you and just hear what you have said, a bunch of things here about standard ways of approaching teaching wise mind.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. I would say from my experience, there's mindfulness, and wise mind is something in addition to mindfulness.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is one of the really interesting conversations that's happening among those who are trying to bring in different wisdom traditions, is how much can you bring in some concept or skills like mindfulness, perhaps divorced or not as embedded in the broader tradition, And from my way of thinking about wise mind, you know, the explicit teaching of wisdom, of I think of it as a sort of intuition, but also discernment is another word that really resonates for me. So it's definitely, I would agree with the, you know, I like all the definitions of mindfulness, and yet for me there's something more than that. It's this skillful means coming in a certain type of effortless way, you know, where wise action is straightforward, even if it's not easy. You know, it might be a very, very difficult thing, but it's something more about this clarity or unity, some sort of non-duality, some way of being influenced by all of the situational internal factors and those coming together with a coherence that fits the moment. So I think of it as definitely requiring mindfulness, but maybe something more than mindfulness as well. What do you think, before I go on to any other things, what do you think about that?
Well, one thing I pick up out of that is, I guess you're sort of differentiating mindfulness as a practice, or various practices.
Or a quality of awareness.
Or a quality of awareness. But I wonder if part of what you're saying here, and this could be my addition to it, but I'm not sure, is that in that wise mind is a, it's not something that you do as much as something that happens. And it happens under certain conditions where, and it brings together a lot of important streams or elements or forces into a moment. And that wise mind, I still have trouble with the concept, the exact term, but wise mind is that confluence that's brought together of important elements so that things are synergistic or synthesized at least. And it brings to a certain kind of coherence. It might, for instance, in my example about the college search process, bring together, you know, my own past. It might bring together rational thoughts about how do you search, emotional responses. It might deep values, a relationship. I mean, I wonder if you can apply what you're saying to, or either to that or pick a different example.
Yeah.
Because it's still, you know, it's still what the hell is wise mind anyway, is still lingering out there.
Well, let me put forward some things, okay? So when you look toward the research about how people might define, you know, what is it exactly we're referring to? One thing, this type of, especially if you think about intuition or the integration, like if you think about a mathematician who gets a creative insight, it's grounded in all of the reason, and yet there's some other something that lets you make that leap, and it might take you a while before you can actually explain how you got there. So I think of there's some quality to what at least I mean when I'm referring to wise mind that some of the research on this would say is like pattern recognition, that the ways our brains work, if you're experienced in an area, you know, experienced people but not novices, recognize a pattern. So some of what we might be referring to in wise mind is this ability to recognize, it's almost like signal to noise, like you can recognize that's correct or that's right for me. And so I think some of what is meant by wise mind is, because, for example, I don't know if I would have wise mind in a situation that was completely novel to me. I might have access to my values, but in terms of, like, what should I do, I might not know. You know, what would I refer back to? I'd probably refer back to more episodic memory. And so that's actually another, it was a really interesting thing that people were talking about is, so let me go to this other way of thinking about it, which is in an experiment, they found that people can physiologically start to respond to something that they're not aware of much before they're able to articulate something.
Mm-hmm.
And so if I gave you a stack deck, so one set of cards is stacked in some way and another mm-hmm. set of cards is normal, there's a way before you can even detect, sort of at a conscious level, your physiology is responding differently to that stacked deck, the off deck. Something's mm-hmm. off, something's wrong. So mm-hmm. I think another, at least for me, another aspect of wise mind is like it's embodied cognition. It's
well, wait. That idea. I want to hear where you go with that. So let's say if I understand the experiment right, that you know somebody's going through some cards and they their physiology betrays, if somebody's studying their physiology at that moment by whatever scanning or whatever sampling devices are going on, that there is the person is recognizing a change in pattern or something like that. They aren't aware of that. Now, what do you think that has to do with wise mind?
Yeah, I think wise mind is, at least for me, is the ability to recognize physical sensations and interpret them at a fundamental level. So my example there is actually this sort of pattern recognition. We once had a party at our house, and there was a man there, quite esteemed by this community who we're having the party with. And there was just something about the way he was looking at my daughter, who was then, I think, 7. And I felt very uncomfortable. And she wanted to show him her room, and I just wouldn't allow it. And I had the sense, you know, that there's something really off about that guy. Mm-hmm. Even though, you know, you would just never think that. And later it turned out he actually was convicted of being a child molester.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, what was I reading? I think there's something to me about wise mind or intuition here, that in a way you read a situation, your bodily cues, in a way that informs you that you can't always justify it. But if you can trust it and you can work with it, develop it over time, check it out against the, you know, follow-up consequences, that there's some sort of intuitive or pre-verbal or just outside your awareness that also comes into play that I think is part of wise mind. Or at least that's what I mean when I'm thinking about what am I referring to, and there's a clarity or a certainty that's part of it, an embodiedness to it. What do you think?
Well, it's a really interesting example. I mean, because you could say that pattern recognition, you're seeing him behave, and you're kind of matching him up against previous experiences registered and represented as imagery and probably stored to some degree in the hippocampal area. So you're sort of doing pattern recognition the way you see on sort of detective shows where they have a face and they're trying to run it against a data bank of faces coming up, millions of faces until it clicks. You know, so you're doing that with your brain. So there's kind of a rational process, but there's also kind of a discomfort. There's kind of an emotional process. Mm-hmm. And there's an intuitive process that's just as kind of you're recognizing something is happening that you're uncomfortable about. And then you took the step that everybody else wishes they had taken when they had situations like that, if they didn't and if it turned out bad. You sort of tuned in, you might say, you know, to yourself and thought, no, this is not okay. And you stopped it without any more evidence than that. So I do mm-hmm. think there was a kind of wise mind. And I think that part of one of the qualities of wise mind that this, I think, grasps is that it's sort of like in wise mind, there is the process of lived experience streaming through you at that moment. And then there is this somehow for some ability to kind of stand one step above that stream, like a balcony seat above a play. And from this one step removed, this enhanced attention, as it was said in one of these definitions, enhanced attention, a certain kind of awareness, and it's not obviously not just cognitive awareness. You know, it happened, and then you acted on what you might say you acted on wise minds. It told you something, and then you sort of ran probabilities. I mean, you thought this might not seem very cool, but you know, in the back of your wherever you run probabilities in the brain, you ran probabilities that I'm not willing to go with this. It's risk management.
But Charlie, I think it's, I mean, this may be a difference, and I think it's really interesting. As to me, it's not a step, it's not the balcony at all. It's more a sense of unification of body mind.
It's unification, but then you acted on it.
Yeah, but which was not at all a pause or a step.
I don't want what I'm saying to be broken down into saying there is a step, because to say there's a step takes it further than I mean it. I just mean there's awareness. There's something, some version of a sort of a synthetic awareness of several things. And when I say awareness, you'd say, well, what is aware of what? Or you just want to say awareness is just a phenomenon in itself. It doesn't require a subject and an object. So I guess you could put it that way.
I see what you're saying. Yeah, there's something about the balcony metaphor for me that doesn't fit my actual physical experience of wise mind.
My physical experience is
more like almost literally in my gut, you know, like how people say a gut feeling. It's more gut heart.
This might get to, you know, in teaching Wise Mind with DBT's skills module, and you have these different avenues to Wise Mind or different procedures that generate or might move you toward Wise Mind. I mean, you might just observe, oh, there's something off about this. You don't quite know what it is yet, but there's a process of observing, and because you've had a validating enough life, you can say, and you know what? I trust my observation, whatever it is. And then there's labeling, there's describing, and both of those, I think, do almost fit. I mean, the balcony seat metaphor is a little, it's too concrete, and I don't want to be taken that literally, so I'm glad you brought it up. But it's more just to try to grasp some heuristic way to put it. But, you know, what I think you're describing more is what you would really come directly to in what's called participating. So, because I think participating is just what you did. You just went with it. And that is, I think, another way of opening up to the current lived stream of experience, complex as it is. I mean, the integration of my own definition of wise mind would include it's sort of the bringing together of heart, mind, and soul.
Yeah.
And heart, mind, and soul, to me, you know, you might say that's emotions and rational and deep values. Or something like that, but it's where it kind of comes together and you go with it. And that, to me, is participate. And anything you do, like to judge the situation, to compare the situation, to analyze the situation rationally, you're already out. Or even the balcony metaphor suggests that too much. You're already out of just being there, just sensing something with awareness and going with it. Which I think there's something like discovering one's true self. I want to read you something. Where is this? Because it's so much like this. This is from a book about learning to write. And it's called If You Want to Write. It's famous for writers. Brenda Uland wrote about this. And there's so many wise things in it, and
I was just reading it the other day, and I realized before this is very much like it. And here, okay, so it's a lot like what. Let me just see. Okay, no, you must not do that. The only way to find your true self is by recklessness and freedom. If you feel like a murderer for the time being, write like one. In fact, when you're in a fury, it's a wonderful time to write. It will be brilliant. That, provided that you write about what you're furious at and not some dutiful literary bilge. That's another reason why I think it's a fine thing to write. People who do it do not ignore anymore the bad passions in themselves and shut their eyes to them, ostrich-like, but begin to take a good and interested look at these passions and try to understand them, and are even glad that they have them because it has set them thinking. This doesn't quite get to it yet, but here. Only by writing and by long, patient, serious work will you find your true self. And why find it? Because it is, I think, your immortal soul and the life of the spirit. And if we can only free it and respect it and not run it down and let it move and work, it's the way to be happier and greater. And she goes on and has a little footnote about how you can do this as a prize fighter. You can do this as a cook who's making a new cake. You can do it as someone who looks at a fashion magazine and just recognizes something that absolutely clicks. And it's this quality of participating that I think you're talking about there. And I still don't know where in there, you know, I think this is a process that I think is what I think of as Wise Mind, because it has a lot of the same ingredients. And what I like about the concept of Wise Mind is that even though it still deserves a title of what the hell is it anyway, it still points my mind in a direction of thinking that there is such a possibility, so that if I'm lost, or there's too much going on, or I just know I'm out of sync, and I have this concept of Wise Mind, that's where I think it turns out to be an incredible skill. It just starts to wake you up.
Yeah.
And it
doesn't
get you there yet, but it's almost like, okay, there is such a thing as a wise-minded way of going about it, and I'm smart enough right now to know that I'm not there.
That one of the things that stands out to me about that quote is the encouragement of getting free from what I would call aversive control, the inhibitions, the things that sort of shut down the more free operant, the behavior that would come out if there was no thing that was going to punish it, sort of one's natural inclinations, first responses. And I do think Wise Mind has that quality also. I often, when I'm thinking about getting to Wise Mind, one of the first steps besides settling the mind is to allow my mind to let go of all of the rules, obligations, et cetera, you know, to really step out from. And I think similarly for creativity and intuition about, you know, what's needed. I think there's something about this anchoring in one's values, but letting go of the situational constraints a little bit. That's also involved in Wise Mind. If I think about what are the control, like when is Wise Mind most likely to arrive, I think figuring out how to get into that mindset is pretty important.
Well, I
sometimes.
Think, you know.
Yeah.
Pardon? Go ahead.
I was going to say sometimes. I just was remembering the other. Sometimes it's not a process at all. It's instantaneous. I was thinking of on a kid's residential unit. A kid had been told no, and you could see ramping up into what was going to end up with a physical restraints. And one of his favorite counselors was across the room watching the escalation happening between him and the other counselor who was giving the consequence. And just as it was kind of reaching the peak, the counselor, his favorite counselor, yelled across the room, you know, hey, his name, what would Wise Mind say? And immediately the kid came back with back down, go chill out in my room.
Mm-hmm.
And in that instant, he turned on a dime and did it. I mean, but like really amazing. And so it's not necessarily
amazing.
And I think that there's sometimes a process of getting twice, but sometimes you just access it.
Well, sometimes it's just almost right there. Maybe it just takes one thing like that. I was teaching this to a patient of mine not very long ago. I won't say anything that would even potentially be identifying about this person, but I was teaching because there isn't an available group right now that they could get into. So I was teaching just starting out, and they brought in a situation with a friend who had been particularly unkind, and then this person basically, in sort of a moment, practically broke off the relationship, and when coming to the session was aware of wishing that they hadn't done that. So this was a perfect opportunity to talk about, you know, what kind of state of mind. After I taught the states of mind, and then I started teaching, and I taught the concept of wise mind, this person tried to understand it by saying, well, oh, okay, so that's what I do because I detached myself from where I was, and I could practically see myself. God, she maybe must have heard about my balcony metaphor. and because, in fact, described a situation of almost being out of body, dissociative, detached, looking down at it. And I said, no, that's not it. Well, then what is it? I mean, rational mind, I did just make a decision that this is too painful, so I'm just going to end it. So I did what I think was a good idea, but now I don't know if it was a good idea. So what if you had just stayed right there, then and there? Do you think you would have ever been able to just stay there, notice the impact of the painful emotions, and notice what this person had done, and notice that you really wanted to get out of there and end it, and notice that you wanted to depart from your body? Have you ever been in a position where you can just kind of be there and just stay there and see what comes next?
Yeah.
And actually, in the next session, because then I taught observe and describe in the rest of that meeting, and this person came back the next week and said, you know, it happened it was a pet that had rejected them and was very painful, and just stayed there, and just stayed right there, engaged with the pet, engaged with the feeling, engaged with everything around it, the urge to really be mean to the pet or to just leave, stayed there and reported that something happened that just never happens, which is everything just kind of like moved along, and then it seemed to be okay. And it didn't seem like she had pushed anything under the rug. And I think, you know, trying to grope, it's easier to talk in a given situation yourself or with a patient about how you're reaching for this and how it turns out to be useful than to talk in the abstract about what it is. It's kind of like, how does wise mind kick in? Because I sort of think it's something that you set the stage for. You cultivate it in a way, and then, boom, it happens. That's why I said I think it's more something that happens. It's like, you know, it's like having, I guess there's no censor here, having sex. So that you set the stage, and everything happens up to a certain point, but you can't make an orgasm happen. Mm-hmm. You can prepare for a joke, but you can't make it be funny. And I think there's something similar where involuntary or something just automatic kicks in. And I'm not sure I would think it was wise mind unless it included a little bit of that element.
That's interesting.
Something flowing, something happening, something coming together.
you know, mm-hmm. Archimedes waking up with a brilliant idea or something, a synthesis.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense to you?
It does. I do think of it as a flow, flow state. But then this quality of your client's thinking, there's this process of, again, I just think of it as discernment or reflection. And all spiritual communities and scientific communities have this same thing as, you know, there's the recognition that certainty, these senses of clarity, et cetera, can also be off, you know, can be incorrect, can be biased, mm-hmm. given mm-hmm. how our brains work. So mm-hmm. there's some, so I think the process through which, you know, so she said here it was a sudden thing, and then there was this follow-up conversation with a trusted other.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I think that there's something about, there's the staying, there's the watching, you know, not doing all of your habits.
Mm-hmm.
But then I think there's some other, and I don't think it always pulls you out. I think this is really interesting because there's the moment of clarity, but mm-hmm. I don't think that the discernment or the wrestling is that process not wise mind? Do you know what I mean? Like I think it's really interesting. Is that friction part of the arising of it? You know, the friction of discernment, this struggling, this okay, wait a second, is this or isn't this? Was it the right move for your client to end that suddenly?
Yeah, I guess you could say at a certain moment, that my client could think that was wise mind. You know, I ended it. And maybe in certain circumstances that is wise mind. And this is often in teaching it in a skills group, I think, where it gets challenging. I mean, it's genuinely challenging. It isn't like people don't understand it. Even people understand it. It's challenging. Like, how do you know that, like, walking out, you know, my younger son is just turned 14. He's a hockey player. I spend a lot of time in rinks. So I can't help but share metaphors because it's painful to spend that much time in rinks sometimes. But it's also fun, and I've come to love hockey. But my son happens to be a kind of like, I never thought I would raise somebody who I would call the enforcer. But he's really the enforcer of the team. And, you know, he really can, he's just really big and strong. And when he's playing, even today I was watching him, and when he comes up to somebody, let me tell you, he's not in any balcony seat when he decides whether to knock someone to the ice. I mean, it just happens. I mean, it mm-hmm. happens in a moment, and it brings together a knowledge of who has this other player been throughout this game. How has mm-hmm. he treated us? How has he treated my fellow players, including some of the smaller ones? You know, what exact position am I in? Where's the puck? Would this be a good idea if I do something with it I could get a penalty for? It's just unbelievable how many things have to be decided mm-hmm. in an instant. And then he moves, and he's very mm-hmm. skillful at this. He really knows how to deliver hits and stuff like that. And I'm always jarred, like, oh, my God, poor kid. You know, that he knocked down, and I should talk to him afterwards. And then I kind of like just let it flow for a little bit, and I think, you know, it's, in a way, it's just perfect what he did. And there was a kind of like automatic move that mm-hmm. all of his hockey training up to now has set the stage for. And then it happens. And so I think of that as wise mind mm-hmm. again
yeah.
happening. I think it happens yeah. when we have a conversation sometimes. I think one of the reasons that I've wanted to do this series with you to begin with is that I find an experience sometimes when you and I are talking of just listening to you. Then, you know, I'm going over my thoughts, I'm hearing your thoughts, and there's a playful back and forth. And at certain points, it just feels like suddenly there's a movement forward that, you know, is again, there is a flow to it. And there's wise mind, I might say, you know, it took a lot of work to get to this moment, but actually something then has changed.
teaching sometimes. You're teaching something that you know, and it doesn't feel totally integrated or in a flow. I guess the flow states and the people who've identified flow and have done biological research on what's meant by flow, you know, it's something at a certain point kicks in, and when I'm teaching, I know when it happens, but I don't know exactly how I get there.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't, teaching it is difficult, but
well,
you
how
have
do
to,
you teach it? I was
well,
going to say, I think we should spend the part of time we have is maybe saying something about how do you get there? Do you think so?
Yeah. Well, when I teach it, I think the single most important thing is that you really try in a dialogue. I try in a dialogue back and forth. It's all from examples. And, I mean, there's the concepts. But actually, you can't talk about them very far, just like we couldn't talk about them very far without starting to have your example, for instance, of the guy at your house and me having the examples that I've had. And I think that I teach it, first of all, by after trying to explain what I mean by wise mind and having a dialogue with the group, then asking each person to see if they can identify a moment. And I try to give examples of moments that aren't like the equivalent of thinking of the double helix. You know, it's like, you know,
exactly.
Just
more like
simple...
pairing a nice wine with a good dinner that you've never done before.
Right. Yeah. Or just like you're digging a hole in your yard and you just realized you're digging, you got to slightly go this direction instead of that direction. It just comes together. You know,
whatever
it is, you know, trying to get examples that are really like absolutely daily life wise mind kicking in. And and then use those examples to go back to, well, where's the rational mind? Where's emotion mind? And what's the intuitive part? And how did that happen? And but mainly saying, you got it. You know, you got it. You got it. And so that everybody gets it, I just think is really important. And everybody gets it with a different example. So that's where I start before I go into the use of the six skills to try to get there. But the core of the whole module is wise mind. In fact, in a way, one of the cores of the whole treatment is sort of like mentalization-based therapy. The core of the whole treatment is what the hell is mentalization anyway? And how do you get there? And how do you get it to happen?
Yeah,
I mean,
right,
and I think in some ways, and when I used to do object relations therapy with Kernberg, that later was called transference-focused therapy. It was sort of like, what the hell do we mean by splitting and integration anyway? And it's kind of like, and how do you get there? And I think in DBT, one of the things is, what is wise mind? Because it's dialectical, and it's accepting, and it's effective. It has a lot of the core of DBT in it. And so I think it's huge to try to just have everybody get it 1 week.
Yeah, right.
What do you do anything? Is it something like that you do?
I like, I really like the asking and listening for an answer to lead a practice.
Yeah, I do too.
Where people,
that is good.
And, you know, for people who are maybe uncomfortable with any aspects of the Zen stuff, there's centering prayer that's a very similar contemplative but Christian approach. The same sort of open awareness, listening. And in that context, listening really for, you know, the heartfelt connection, God's voice, different, people have different ways of talking about it, but that kind of internal voice one hears.
Right.
You know, the other one, Tara Brochlet exercise that I've really used a lot myself of getting, you know, finding that difficult moment and then getting right to the edge of where it's the very most difficult and it doesn't go well for you or whatever, and then imagining that some wise being, you know, Buddha, Jesus, your Aunt Mary, you know, steps into your body.
Not my Aunt Mary, I tell you that.
And then takes over the interaction, and you get to stand at the sidelines, and the wise person, you know, takes it. And so in your imagination, your imagination comes up with very wise things. And so mm-hmm. I think that's another one that for me is to is a very fast way to find a way forward in a difficult moment that's based more on wisdom, a kind of integrated sense of what's needed.
Mm-hmm.
And I always
mm-hmm.
like that pebble, you know, the sliver of rock that's thrown into the water and floats down mm-hmm. slowly, slowly, slowly until it settles. That physical grounding is mm-hmm. very much associated with wise mind for me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think I'm sure this is the same for you too, that how I teach this, if I'm teaching a group of teenage boys,
yeah.
it's going to be different than if I'm teaching,
yeah.
you know, a different group. I mean, you really, yeah. it's kind of, you have to know the concept really well and have a lot of ways to go. And I used to teach a lot. I've always been a basketball fan, and the book Sacred Hoops by Phil Jackson from a lot of
yeah,
years ago
great
of
book.
Sort of how you weave together mindfulness and basically wise mind with coaching the Chicago Bulls with Michael Jordan, Scottie Pippen, and these other guys, and especially Dennis Rodman, who was really different, and what's a mindful way to do that himself, and how? So I think it's kind of like finding examples that work, like, and then going from there. You know, we aren't going to have time now to talk about then the teaching of the six core skills, but then, you know, and of course, we're just restating some of the manual when we do that, because it's
yeah,
the manual
yeah.
is so good. I mean, it has so many questions to ask, but I think each one of the core skills, one of the things I've learned over time is each one has a different way of getting there when you really
yeah.
think in a sort of fine-tuned way. You know, how do you get there through
yeah.
Being effective or being non-judgmental or being or describing? So,
yeah.
Hey,
Charlie, that describing made me think of one other book, Natalie Goldberg, Writing mm-hmm. Down the Bones. That's mm-hmm. another fast way to wise mind, I think. Her book gives a lot of useful
you
ways.
You always have such great suggestions. Writing Down the Bones?
Yeah, Natalie Goldberg.
Natalie Goldberg.
Yeah.
All I have to do is talk to you once a month, and I've got all of my reading set up for the next month. I never catch up. Then you give me another one. Well, I think we have about 3 minutes before 9, and I think that we should sort of stop here so Jim can wrap things up and make any comments that need to be made. But thanks, Kelly.
Yeah, it was really, really interesting, Charlie.
Interesting to me. Great.
Really?
Oh, and by the way, I think next time might be, I don't have the dates in front of me, I think it's after November, is it? I think it's... because I wanted to just quickly say one thing about, let me just see if I got it in my book here.
Very
yeah, December 1st. I had
yeah.
thought, since you and I are both going to be at ABCT and Is It DBT, a couple weeks before that, I wonder if we might want to just think now of each of us picking something from that conference
okay.
to talk about.
The coolest stuff we heard?
The coolest stuff. Why don't we call it that? It'll be the coolest stuff that we heard at ABCT and Is It DBT.
Oh, that'd be fun. Okay,
yeah,
cool.
Okay.
I would like that.
Okay, so Jim?
Thank you. Thank you for a very interesting session. And best things that you heard or saw, sounds like a tremendous, wonderful dissemination to the BPD committee from the convention. So thank you for that great idea, and really look forward to the session. Just a reminder, next Sunday, Mary Zanarini will be presenting on her update on her longitudinal research that's had such impact on the field. And again, if these sessions are consider the value of these sessions, that if you were to buy a book or order a scientific research paper, or go to a meeting with the travel costs, the registration costs, the meals, the hotel expenses, and allocate that in terms of the time to have the convenience of this coming right to you, wherever you are, in your home or your office or on the road, tuning in with your smartphone, and make a donation on the NEA BBT webpage to help pay the cost. And thank you all to those staff. We really appreciate your support. It makes a real difference. See you all. Talk to you all. See you all next Sunday.
Right. Good. Thanks, Jim. Thank you.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Okay.
Bye.
All right. Great. Bye-bye.